Welcome everyone, this is all about Windows Phone Insight Podcast 214, recording this on 29th of April 2017. You may not hear it till the bank holiday Monday, but we're recording this on a Saturday. I'm Steve Litchfield, with me I have Rafe Blanford.
Hello everybody. Yes, apologies that it's been a little while since you heard, well, from me especially. We've had a lot on. You can probably tell we're recording this on a weekend because we wanted to squeeze this in. We know we haven't had one for a while and there's quite a bit to talk about. I'll hand over to Steve for the kind of usual kickoff.
Yes, and thanks to our various guests we've had over the last few months. It's been great having some different voices. And if you out there would like to feature as a guest on the podcast, then do drop me a line via the usual methods and we'll see if you're eligible to have enough geeky Windows-related stuff to chat about. It'd be good to hear yet more voices on the podcast. Yes, first story, Rafe, are looking at the various phone upgrade paths. People were getting very confused online as to which of generations and which particular devices running Windows Phone 8 and Windows 10 Mobile would get the various OS upgrades, and of course whether it matters ultimately, which is, I guess, is another question. Looking at the table, and this is a fairly large table which hopefully most people can see on one screen or another, looking at on the article, Rafe, I've kind of color-coded it as I tend to do. Green mean in the table means that basically that version of the operating system is available for that device. Orange means you can get it via the insider rings, though that, of course, is not guaranteed forever. But my contention, looking at the range of models over the last 4 years and the range of operating system upgrades, I don't think Microsoft's done too badly at keeping most people on board most of the time. I know there are a few enthusiasts, specifically with people like the 830, 930, 1520, who feel a tiny bit abandoned. But we'll come to that in a moment because I have a tutorial for that as well. But what's your overall impression looking at the swathe of colour in that table?
Well, I think you're right. I mean, it's always been the way in the smartphone world that the more recent smartphones are more likely to get the updates. I guess you could be disappointed if you bought some of the non-Microsoft or non-Nokia devices over the years, because actually they typically have had sort of worse support. And, you know, we've seen that in things like the devices from Samsung and HTC. Having said that, you know, Alcatel kind of balanced that out a bit. The only thing I'd say is that kind of some of the Lumia devices that you might expect to be supported for a couple of years haven't quite made it. Again, to be fair, it tends to be the lower end device, which of course have less room for maneuver. You know, and you look at something like the 930 or the 1520, and you know that isn't going to get the latest update officially. Although, as you know, you can get it via the insider. Is that a big deal? Actually, that's a device that's getting quite old now. So yeah, that's probably about right. I mean, I may have expected to get this update. I mean, a while back, I remember in the heyday of Lumia, they sort of said effectively you'll get N plus two updates. You know, the implication there would be basically 2 years of updates, and that's roughly what we're seeing. And honestly, it's typically what we see elsewhere as well. I mean, Apple is sometimes a bit better than that, but actually even Apple, it's sort of somewhat hidden, because once you get over that 2 or 3 year mark, you don't get all of the updates on the older devices. And maybe that's the one thing that could be improved here, in that, you know, could you bring across some of it, but not everything? But that obviously is a much bigger software development effort, and, you know, given the number of devices we're talking about, probably can't be justified in any shape or form. I think the other thing is, actually, you know, if you look at this, you go, okay, August 2016, spring 2017, and then threshold being back in, well, effectively Q1 2016 for most people, that's actually kind of three updates over a 18-month-ish period. And so we've had quite a lot of Windows 10 Mobile branches. So the other thing is, actually, I think they've done quite a good job on delivering numerous updates, certainly compared to the old days where, you know, it could be a year or more between, or even 18 months between, not even the major updates, kind of some of the minor updates. So yeah, it's about fair, but you're always going to get some people that are disappointed. And I suppose the other thing, the overriding impression that this gives me when I look at this, I go, how relatively few Windows devices have been announced in recent years. And you know, that's actually very disappointing for obvious reasons, but is really reflecting the changes that, you know, Nokia and Microsoft went through. And you know, I don't want to call it it's the sort of decline and fall of the ecosystem, but you have to be realistic and say there's been far fewer devices. And so therefore you might suspect that there's a few more people holding on to their devices for a bit longer, or switching away to another platform altogether. And so I suspect actually there's probably a bit more disappointment than there might have been in the past, because people would have held on to the old devices. Yeah. You know, they may have switched to something else and go, oh, I can't keep current with Windows anymore, and therefore they're lost to the ecosystem. And I'm really talking more about people using it as a second device here, because certainly, you know, if you're anything like me, you probably got devices from, you know, iOS, Android, and Windows, and, you know, your main one you probably update fairly frequently, but some of the other platforms may not get such a frequent update. And so what I would fear here is that people who have continued to have an interest in Windows, even if it isn't their main device, might be on a device like, you know, the 830, for example, or, you know, potentially something like the 930 as well, or even one of the low-end devices. And up until this point, they've been able to get all the updates, and they still can via Insider, but they may be, you know, less on the ball with that sort of thing. And so I think it's fine this time. Actually, the real test will probably come on the next big update.
Yeah, yeah. When Redstone 3 hits, which is scheduled for September, but I suspect it'll be more like October, November. I suspect the 950 XL, etc., maybe, and the, of course, the Elite X3 and the Alcatel Idol 4S with Windows 10, they may be the only devices officially to get those. Mm. And even then, there may be some suspicion that, that some of those devices may persist through the Insider program through to Redstone 4. So things are, I think it's very much as expected. You mentioned N plus 2 there, two major upgrades. And let's face it, almost every device there has had at least two. Some have had three upgrades. So yeah. As devices, you mentioned a couple that were particularly disappointing. I suspect, as you alluded to there, that you're talking about real budget devices like the Lumia 525, which basically...
And they did make up you know, big volume of the sales.
Admittedly, they did, but they're also, they're very budget phones with budget expectations, and the sort of people who bought those phones, they weren't expecting multiple Windows 10 mobile branch updates. They were just expecting a phone that they could use for an 18 months and then chuck away or pass down to a kid or something. So I'm actually encouraged by by building the table. It encouraged me. The fact that Microsoft has said that devices like the 735, 830, 930, Icon, 1520, all, which, let's face it, are some of the most popular Lumias from our AWP world over the last 5 years, all of those four or five devices, they're still going to be maintained with security updates, with OS updates through the Insider program. And that's why this is a good place to slinkily link into a tutorial I wrote and put up a couple of days ago, basically guiding people through that process of what to do if you've got a Lumia 930 or any of those other models and you want to get right through to the creator's update and stay maintained. And it involves a bit of hopping and skipping and jumping, Rafe. Now, we've kind of been used to this with Microsoft. Jumping around the various Insider rings without losing data is always a tiny bit fragile. And obviously, a good advice is to have good backups and to be aware that you might have to rebuild and resync your data at some point. But if people follow my tutorial, basically going taking their device from Windows Phone 8.1, if needed, up to Threshold. From Threshold, you get to Anniversary Update, keep up at the back. From Anniversary Update, you go to the slow ring, Insider ring, and then immediately you get another configuration update. You then get another stability update. You then go to the release preview. And if that all sounds horrendous, that's why I wrote an article, so that people just follow it through from end to end. It does take about 2 hours of real time, but at the end of it, all of those most popular Lumias, basically, they will be on the latest creators update, and they will be good to go for platform updates and security updates right through 2017, and, you know, maybe even beyond there in terms of fixes. So some of those devices will be 4+ years old at that point, and I think that's jolly good going.
Yeah, I'd agree, and that, you know, that timeline where you switch, you know, whether you say 2 years or 3 years or 4 years for a device life cycle. No, I actually think four years at that point, you have to be realistic. If it's less than that, you know, yes, you can be disappointed. And even on that 4 year timeline, you know, you have to be quite dedicated towards getting the updates. And, you know, the same is true elsewhere, or at least you need to be careful or think about it. It is fair to say, Steve, isn't it, that people following your instructions are probably going to be amongst the more dedicated people if they're wanting to get the latest update. Because like you say, it's a bit of a hassle to jump through it. I mean, I still see quite a few people with Windows devices, and talking to them, most of them just aren't that into their smartphone tech.
I don't know that one.
Or indeed your Alexa isn't either.
Thank you, Alexa, in the background. Yes, I probably shouldn't mention that word. And yeah, they're just not that into their smartphone tech, so they won't go through it. But for those who want to, it's great that you've got the ability to do so. And I think that's such a change from a few years ago, well, more than a few years ago, actually, where it always was a pain getting these things. And we, you know, I've said in the past, really appreciate Microsoft doing it. And particularly given the state of the ecosystem, the fact that you, you know, can get access to the latest things. You know, it's a very PC-like world in the sense of, you know, being able to install the latest updates, and you've got these choices. Frankly, I'm quite impressed that it works as well as it does, given there's so many permutations here. But that probably also speaks to the standardization of kind of the software and the hardware in one sense. And I suspect there are times when it's not quite tuned. We know that from using the updates, but the whole point is if you're on something like Fast Ring, you kind of have to accept there'll be instability. Probably the one to go for, though, is the slow ring, given the current scenario that we always talk about, this timeline between you know, having the latest version, having the stable thing. But given that we're just, well, we've got Creator's Update, being on slow is probably the perfect place to be right now for most people, Steve.
Well, only if they've got the 950 XL, because
that's true.
Yeah, because otherwise most of the people on those popular devices we've just been mentioning, they're not supported at all on the slow ring as soon as that slow ring makes the jump to Redstone 3, which will be in the next couple of months. So you may well put your 1520 up to the slow ring, think, woohoo, I'm good to go. But in about June or sometime, you'll be left high and dry. So I think, yes, by all means, for the latest devices, the 950, 950 XL, 650, even the 550, even the 640 XL, you could probably live with the slow ring and, you know, experience Redstone 3 and go forward at a relatively stable yet relatively fast pace. But for it really depends which device you're on, which again, refer people to back to the grid, which we'll link to in the show notes.
Yeah, that's a good point, actually. Because it's always going to be device specific, but the general rule is more recent devices you can be on slow ring, unless you like living on the edge. The older devices, if you want access to the more recent updates, probably have to accept a bit more instability but go for fast ring. But kind of check all the writing, because Steve has, I think, documented it in exhaustive detail, and we'll be able to, if you read through all that, you'll be able to sort of get our advice, and we don't really want to go through 10 plus different devices to say which is which.
Yeah, I would hesitate to call myself a world authority, but in an increasingly
definitely you are.
In an increasingly shrinking Windows Phone centric world, I mean, I may well end up being a world authority. So there we go. the Creator's Update, the final build, what we think will be the final build, 15.063.251 is now up and apparently rolling out for some devices in some regions, which is Microsoft's way of saying, hey, we got it out on the date we said we'd release it, if only for one device. But I suspect that's going to be rolling out over the next few months. I've got a test 640, test 640 XL. Neither of those have got it yet, and they are on production status. So this is clearly a staged rollout, and that's the way to do things. Even in the, I know the iPhone does things differently, Rafe, but then they have the various in-depth beta programs. On Android, Google does tend to roll things out again. If you've got, say you've got 10 Nexus devices or 10 Pixel devices, and Google releases the latest version of Android, quite often you'll have to wait a week or so, and your neighbor with the identical device will get it a week before you, because they're literally rolling it out according to a random set of serial numbers, just to monitor it and see how it's going and ease it out into the world, rather than just blast it out to everyone all at once. If that was me as a business doing that sort of rollout, I would do it the same way, because I'd want to keep a very close eye on all the metrics and work out that things were going well. I think Apple Apple has the luxury of completely homogenous hardware. It knows exactly what's going to happen when its update hits its hardware. Whereas in the Windows Phone, Windows 10 Mobile world, there are a few more models, and the Android world, of course, it's even more models. So I think that's why Apple gets away with it. But I think Microsoft's approach here and just rolling it out stage by stage, region by region, variant by variant, I think it's justified.
Yeah, I mean, I can remember that this has long been the case. It was on one of the older Lumia devices, depending on which colour variant you had, sometimes that could even dictate.
Which colour?
Which, you know, made no sense at all from a rational point of view, but was, as you say, about this kind of staggered update and all of that. And of course, when you get to a big volume of devices, like when we're talking about, say, the Android world, actually you need to do that, because you also have to think about managing the load of people downloading the updates and all that sort of thing. I mean, Apple, as usual, law unto itself, but they have a really, really extensive testing program. And actually, in one sense, you're right to say they've got fewer SKUs or fewer devices to sort of deal with. But I think their testing program is probably, you know, because they control more of the kind of the stack, actually probably their testing program is hidden to most people, and we don't see very much in the way of signs of it. And just the sheer scale of Apple, of course, you know, it's easily the single most popular device. I'd probably caveat them when talking about some of the Samsung flagships. But anyway, in terms of kind of that approximate story, yes, you know, iPhone or iOS is much more consistent and across just a few devices. And so perhaps easier to do. But also, I think, give Apple credit. They do an amazing job on those updates and delivering them to people. But even they occasionally have the odd fluff. And we've certainly seen, you know, X.01 very quickly followed by X.03 as they discover a bug, even in code that's presumably been very extensively tested. And while they haven't had, you know, a big bricking of devices ever, I think that's always going to be a risk with, you know, the software updates that have got so complex on modern devices.
Yeah, yeah. And I'll put a link also in the show notes to my article a couple of weeks ago, basically looking at what's new in the Creators Update if you're on the anniversary update, i.e. what's new from Redstone 2 from Redstone. And I know a lot of sites are being a bit sniffy about this Creators Update, as in it's, you know, it's not very much of a Creators Update for phone users. You know, where's the Paint 3D on the touchscreen, et cetera, et cetera. And it's not really so much about creation. And I think that's a fair point. But I've got another editorial plan, Rafe, and to give people a tease and you a tease, saying that basically it's us smartphone users. Since 2006, we've been creating things. That was the whole point. That was the thing that got me excited about smartphones in the first place, was on devices like the Nokia N93, which is the first I can remember really being creative on. All of a sudden, your phone was your camera and your camcorder, and you could literally create multimedia on your phone that was always with you in incredibly flexible ways. And that's just got better and better over the years. So I would argue that the Creators Update is basically the PC kind of catching up in a very small way to what us smartphone users have been doing for the last 11 years.
Well, indeed. And of course, you know, Microsoft is always going to name the update after the desktop, where there's a bigger population of users. But yeah, it's interesting you say that, because I actually think one of the big distinctions, I mean, there's some obvious ones in terms of hardware size and form factor and all of that, is actually the sensors on a phone are used way more extensively. And I'm thinking both the camera, the microphone, but also things like the accelerometer. And actually that gives a level of immersion or intelligence to the device that you just don't get elsewhere. And it's one of the reasons they're so popular as personal devices. And there's a very obvious camera capture, and then all of the things that leads to in terms of having apps that you can edit photos with or do special effects, or, you know, the computational photography we've talked about in the past. But there is also kind of the audio element to that as well. And, you know, it's handheld, so you can take it anywhere. And so, yes, it is clearly much more of a creation tool than, I think, you know, the explosion in photography and the sharing of billions of images onto social media or in people's homes has all come about because of, you know, the smartphone and its sensors. In that sense, yes, it's the ultimate creator tool, and it's made everyone, you know, a creative person in a way that's quite hard to imagine. I think, you know, it you get very blasé about this sort of thing, but if you think about the before smartphone era, you know, even with digital cameras, which never achieved that anything like the same level of popularity, if you go back before that, you know, you're talking about it was film cameras and then actually people recording audio or, you know, having camcorders. That was relatively unusual. It's been such a democratizing influence in terms of that capture and creative element. I do think what's interesting on the desktop is, you know, you're kind of seeing, because of the size, that creation of things out of nothing rather than capturing of the real world. And there's an interest, maybe something we could riff on in the future. And that's where I think, you know, that productivity power of the desktop does come in. And 3D Paint is probably the best example of that. But even that now, we're starting to see, you know, smartphones being used for 3D capture in different ways, and so the 360 and sort of enhanced panoramas. And there's been various technology about that over the years. It'd be really interesting to see where that goes, especially if, you know, the idea of kind of 3D creation and capture and actually playback, which is around virtual reality and augmented reality, comes in. Because actually, you know, the smartphone will be a very powerful tool sitting in your pocket. You might just have to think about how it gets used a bit more. So, yeah, I mean, creators is a really interesting subject to talk about. And maybe we'll come back to that in a future podcast.
Okay. And just to mention that in addition to the other minor feature points, which we'll cover in that article, is also the performance aspect. And just again, to tease another article, I'm going to revisit one of my benchmarking features, which are always popular, where I take real-world operations and then compare them to this final new build, latest build of the Creators Update with, for example, the production version of the Anniversary Update, because I want to just quantify, again, as accurately as I can, at 10%, 15%, 20%, how much faster this new kernel, these new modules are. And I think it's significant. And I'm certainly noticing that on, for example, my old 930, it's running buttery smooth, really, with this latest release preview of the Creators Update. So I think there are things to be optimistic there, even if we're a bit depressed about the amount of low amount of new first-party hardware coming out. But that's a story for another day. Just the final story for this podcast, I think we could well take an hour and a half, but we're going to try and shorten it to about 20 minutes. I wanted to document in the five of the biggest mistakes of Windows on mobile. We don't often write, quote, negative pieces on All About Windows Phone, as in negative for negative's sake. But there have clearly been some things that have gone wrong over the last 5 to 10 years. Some by Microsoft, some by Nokia, and there are probably many more than five that people would want to latch on to. But I wanted to pick five of the things that I think were either closest to my heart or particularly big. And I think I suspect, Rafe, that you'll have a bit to say on each of them. So if we can go in reverse order, starting with my number five, this is kind of a hobby horse of mine. We've covered this before, but the Lumia 930 was clearly compromised in terms of design, and Nokia didn't really realize what people wanted, and they missed out glance screen, and they messed up the heat management. So the 930, the moment you do anything serious on it, it just gets hotter than a very hot thing. You have to drop it. You cannot hold it sometimes, it gets so hot. So the 930 arrived at a critical point for Windows Phone 8.1. If the 930 had been absolutely nailed, I think that they would have had a flagship. The specifications of that when it came out were very much competitive with the rest of the market in terms of the Android world. And the fact that the 930 was so meh at the time, I think really let Nokia down and ultimately let the platform down.
Yeah, it's a fair comment. I mean, I think in many ways the 930 and the kind of compromises and conflicts that were apparent, especially afterwards in it, probably reflected the state of Nokia internally, which, you know, clearly was in trouble. And I wonder whether, you know, there was inconsistency in the staffing in the program that put it together. And because that, you know, that was the time at which, you know, you were having a lot of people leave or go elsewhere. I think a lot of people recognized that the company was in trouble. And it's much easier to say that in retrospect, of course. And there were just too many things that were just missing or to criticize about it. And I think particularly if you compare it to some of the hardware that had gone before, and you know, even something like the Lumia 800, which was produced in very trying circumstances, and then some of the earlier factors, you know, things like the 920, and then you can obviously go back to the Symbian era as well, you know, devices that were quite clearly crafted with love and an enormous amount of attention to detail, and actually setting kind of new boundaries or pushing things back a bit. Whereas the 930 just felt like a kind of, okay, we just need to update the 920 and we're not going to pay that much attention. It just didn't break new ground. And it was a time at which they really, really needed to do that. And, you know, there's all sorts of reasons. I mean, you can look at kind of the hardware story around it in that just wasn't ready. You know, some of the things around the camera and stuff like that. Because, I mean, what people sometimes forget is, you know, the smartphone manufacturers are largely constrained by the components that they can get hold of and what have you. And, you know, you actually sometimes see that this even now when, you know, it's almost, we get this sort of TikTok update cycle where, you know, the big thing on the tick when the new chipsets come out and it all aligns properly, and then a top, which is just a minor update, but people are expecting a new device each year. And, you know, you could maybe talk about the S7 from Samsung being one of those minor things and then the S8 being a bigger deal. A lot of that is driven, I think, by the Qualcomm it's not just Qualcomm, any of the silicon, the hardware, the system on the chip, when they take a big step. And I think the 930 was unfortunate in that it kind of combined when Nokia and to a certain extent Microsoft were sort of in a bad place with the kind of circumstances of not having kind of great hardware, a tick, if you like. And that sort of all added up to a device which, you know, in retrospect was really quite not that interesting. And it was sort of set against that story of, you know, Android doing fantastically well, iOS continuing to break new ground. And so I think, you know, you can easily date the rot from earlier than that as well, if you kind of look at the companies and the hardware itself. But this was the one where I think it became arguably more apparent to some of the consumers. And we probably could have done a better job at recognizing that at the time. And to an extent we did, because I do remember some of our discussion around the Lumia 930. You know, you know, like you say, we were complaining about glance screen and stuff like that. What we probably failed to do was step back and take a more you know, systematic or more holistic view and say, you know, why is this happening, rather than just complaining about a single device. But then that won't, you know, it's not what we do as smartphone reviewers. We tend to kind of focus on the individual, and, you know, history is written with the big picture in mind.
And in hindsight.
Yes, yeah, which is exactly what we're doing now.
Yeah, indeed, indeed. And the 930, in hindsight, as one of the last great metal chassis, I mean, the 830 is very similar, but just slimmer. I mean, those were classic designs. I mean, at the time, I don't think the physical design was necessarily the problem. It was some of the internals and some of the decisions and the management and the marketing of the device and the timing of the release of the device, which was 6 months after the American version, the Icon. All of those factors, yeah.
Absolutely. And actually, you know, the 830 is a good thing to talk about because, you know, that was a mid-tier device and, you know, the design and the hardware and the specification worked fine there. Just didn't feel like the 930 or the Icon was, you know, a big step up. And, you know, it's kind of the wrong way around. You kind of expect, you know, the kind of mid-tier version to come later on. So, you know, it, in that sense, a disappointment.
Yeah, in fact, I'd class the 830 as a classic device in its own right. Yeah, you think you're still using it now for one of your sims, is that right?
I am, yes. Well, it's not so much got a main sim in it, but I still use it as a device occasionally.
Yeah, yeah. And I rather rashly swapped away my 830 for another device I fancied testing a year or so ago. So I've been without an 830. So if you're out there and you've got an 830 in a drawer doing nothing, then think of me, because I'd love to put some of the recent builds on and write about it again. So there we are. It's my begging spot over for the podcast. But if anyone has got a spare 830. Now, number four in my list of mistakes Nokia / Microsoft may have made in the ecosystem, I think not starting Windows Phone earlier. Now, my reasoning, Rafe, was that the iPhone clearly kicked things off. It introduced capacitive touch to the world, among other, never mind, you know, iOS, its own idiosyncrasies, many of which haven't been sorted out even today. The fact that the big innovation for me was the fact that it was all screen and it was capacitive, which means you didn't need to worry about fiddly styluses. You didn't see the whole screen flexing every time you press it. That was huge. And that kicked off, of course, every single operating system and platform then tried to adapt capacitive touch. I mean, Symbian tried it. Symbian managed it in 2010, but with things like the Nokia N8, which did okay for it. But that was still a full 3.5 years after the iPhone was announced. Android managed it by September 2008 with its first capacitive touchscreen device. Windows phones, first capacitive made by Microsoft's various licensees, came out in October 2010, a full 2 years after Android, and pretty much synonymous with the Symbian, which was by then very under-resourced and beset by problems within Nokia. So I contend that Microsoft should have started refactoring Windows Mobile 6.5 as it was then and doing something about capacitive touch, doing something about the iPhone's challenge a full 2 years earlier. I don't think Windows Phone 7 was even started internally until the start of 2009, 2 years after the iPhone was first announced, and that's just an eternity.
Yeah, I mean, I can't agree with the kind of the big picture statement here, but I wonder whether you're perhaps indulging in a little bit of revisionist history here. In that, actually, you know, understanding the context of the market back at that time, I'm not, you know, it's very easy with hindsight to make these kind of judgments. And actually, it was harder at the time. It wasn't quite so evident that Apple and Google would become all conquering, you know, certainly if we look back to, you know, the 2008 type timeline. And, you know, you're absolutely right to say Nokia and Symbian kind of making the same mistake. I mean, the other thing to remember about Microsoft is they hadn't been massively successful with Windows Mobile either, but, you know, they were kind of the number two player for, you know, a period of time. And then, you know, Android and iOS came along, and so it was evident what was happening. I'd also point out that Microsoft was trying to do innovative things here. They had their KIN program. Admittedly, it was basically dead on arrival, thanks to a partnership with Verizon that made the data plans absolutely crazy. But the kind of and frankly, there was a bigger problem that it was kind of built around this assumption that the world would look like, you know, the danger messaging devices in the future. And actually, it was always going to be a kind of more open kind of multimedia computing platform, as Nokia would have us describe it. But yes, I mean, I can't agree with, you know, if that had all arrived earlier, yes, we'd be in a different situation. But that's kind of like if wishes were horses type thing. So, yes, it should have started earlier. But and if it started early, you know, I think you can make the same argument about any of the platforms. If they have a little bit more time, you know, they have longer runway. I mean, the other thing is Windows Phone 7 wasn't that great in the way it was kind of locked down or not as flexible. It wasn't really until we got Windows Phone 8 that you can recognize Microsoft's mobile platform was something that was in the right strategic place. And I'm, you know, everyone will remember the breaking compatibility, but you know, it's taken until Windows 10 before you kind of get this more commonality, which I think is actually justifiably something Microsoft can talk about proudly. You know, they tried to do it with Windows Phone 7. That was basically completely untrue. They tried to do it with Windows Phone 8. And so if you squinted a bit, you could see it. Even with Windows Phone 10, you know, there's a certain amount of that. And it's got better. So I just remind you that even if something Windows Phone 6.9, which was sort of mostly Windows Phone 7, had arrived a few years earlier, I suspect that would have been even more true. And it would, you know, that was reflective of, you know, the hardware that it was running on. You know, it just didn't have the kind of resources and capability. So I'll give you that one. But just note that, you know, rose-tinted glasses and hindsight history, Steve.
That's what I specialise in, Rafe. That's how I make my living. Right, number three. We'll try and get through all of these in the podcast. Buying Nokia. This is a contentious one. I'm sure you'll have your own say here, Rafe. I think Microsoft shouldn't have bought Nokia's device division. Before they bought it, they were subsidising Nokia each quarter with a cash payment for various reasons, and that was keeping Nokia going. Now, yes, Nokia needed a shake-up. It needed a complete root out through of the management and the whole infrastructure of how it worked. But at the same time, by taking Nokia in-house, Microsoft put all its eggs in one basket, and it's a basket that it was trying to be Apple. It was trying to be all things to all people itself and not have a vibrant, you know, system of third parties. Now, you could argue that Nokia was the only successful third party in the Windows Phone ecosystem, and that was its own problem. But ultimately, I think by bringing Nokia in-house, Microsoft brought up more troubles on itself than if it had kept Nokia separate and kept on paying them.
Yeah, it's interesting because it was definitely an ambitious plan to do this on the part of Steve Ballmer, and it's been made quite clear that some of his, you know, Satya Nadella and I think some of the other execs, it was a controversial decision and didn't necessarily agree. Again, it clearly hasn't worked out. But I think we also need to remember the situation that Nokia was in at that point. You know, they were losing money, they're hemorrhaging money. And it didn't seem an obvious way to get it fixed. And actually, they wanted to sell off the company. So would they have been able to sell to someone else and the situation been slightly different? Possibly, but I would sort of, you know, cue the kind of wibble music as the screen goes all fuzzy and we imagine an alternative future. What would we be saying about this if Microsoft hadn't bought Nokia and it had either gone bust or been bought by someone else and switched to making, you know, maybe Android devices or something else? You know, Microsoft would be criticizing Microsoft for not trying to save its most important device partner and everything like that. Because I think that the idea that, you know, you could have just kept giving subsidies wouldn't fly from a commercial point of view.
It's, you know, sure.
Again, this is one, clearly it all went wrong, but I think the alternative would have been just as disastrous. And this world where, you know, Microsoft hadn't bought it, it would have fallen out perhaps even earlier. I think the only alternative, you know, maybe the thing to express is they shouldn't have bought Nokia and they should have instead invested all that money in building up their own device division and tried to do Surface phones earlier. But it's trivially easy to say that actually doing that in practice would have been very difficult because we've seen how long it's taken them to do that with kind of the Surface laptop brand and, you know, buying Nokia. And actually, you know, yes, it was a lot of money, but they were buying a lot of expertise and there were a lot of talented people, which probably does quite nicely link us to your penultimate point.
Yeah, absolutely. Number two, I said getting rid of so many of the most talented ex-Nokians. Now, I absolutely understand, Microsoft, that when you merge two huge companies, there are vast swathes of the company, all the infrastructure and the HR and the finances and the marketing, all of these areas which have massive overlap, and you have to get rid of people to be, otherwise you've got duplicate jobs. So I understand that, but some of the people they were letting go and letting leave, some of the technical specialists, we principally know the people in the imaging department, but I'm sure there were others in the communications and chipset department and so forth. And they were letting these critical people go, swan off to other companies, and good luck to the personnel who found new careers. But it does raise the question, is there still enough expertise at Microsoft to produce something really outstanding? Now, I know we saw some of the recent Surface Studio, for example, and the Surface Pros, which you and I both have now. There is clearly some good engineering talent there, but I still think that they missed a trick by not hanging on to some of the people, the more high-profile people who were really talented.
Well, I mean, I think this is a chicken and egg situation in that, you know, they weren't doing so well in terms of device sales, so it was therefore hard to support the large scale teams. And yes, you're right to say, you know, they're always going to be losses that often are in a merger where there's duplication. I'd also point out that a lot of people choose to leave. It's not about Microsoft trying to keep them. And yeah. I know, I'm sure speaking to people, you'd find out that, you know, in some cases they did try and retain them and they, you know, did offer them whatever. But some, you know, if you look at the context of what was happening, I can certainly understand people going, okay, I want to sort of protect my career and go elsewhere. So I think getting rid of talent, it tends to sort of imply that that's, it was all on Microsoft.
Yeah, fair enough.
And don't get me wrong, there's definitely an element of that. But also you have to be realistic and go, that was an inevitable consequence of declining sales. You know, so what comes first, you know, the chicken or the egg? The same applies to this. And, you know, the human impact was pretty grim. And actually, on the whole, Nokia and Microsoft did a pretty good job in all those kind of programs compared to some companies, at least. But I can't imagine what it would have been like to be part of that, you know. And you know, tens of thousands of people, you know, that worked for Nokia in the devices and division, basically very few, none of them left. There's a few still with Microsoft, and they've moved over to slightly different areas. Actually, I still think there's a lot of talented engineers there. And at the same time, I think it's also worth recognizing that the smartphone world became a lot more commoditized in the same period.
Yes.
You know, Nokia actually was one of the manufacturers that did produce quite a bit of things itself, or at least in partnership. And, you know, you can think about some of the camera modules and the microphones. I'm not saying they produced them themselves, but they often had kind of collaboration or co-working. Whereas now, you know, most of the successful devices, particularly in the mid-tier, maybe not so much at the high end, is a lot more off-the-shelf components. Or, you know, it's like Sony, you know, makes way more money from selling its camera sensors than it does from selling its own devices, and they're kind of an acknowledged expert in that space. And, you know, you look at Samsung for screens, and Samsung's a bit of a funny one, of course, because, you know, you've got their smartphone division, but then you've also got their component division, who are selling to a lot of their, you know, smartphone competitors. And that I think there is a subtle change there that's perhaps happened as well. You could definitely identify it on the software side, but, you know, actually there was a switch from Symbian to Windows that had a big impact there. You know, you can talk about marketing, and, you know, that's something that we saw more visibly because of, you know, the nature of, you know, what we were doing. I would say, rather than say this is about getting rid of people, I think it was the drain of talent for whatever reason it happened, whether that was through redundancy programs, people choosing to leave, or the changing marketing context. You know, Nokia and then Microsoft's device division had to operate in a very different context. And as a result, it kind of lost the advantage it had of having a lot of talented engineers. And that's an oversimplification, but I just think you can't just lay it at the door of kind of corporate ignorance or stupidity. I think, you know, you have to recognize there's a broader story here. But yeah, you know, it definitely had an impact. And I think what I'd say here is the thing that made the Nokia devices special wasn't there. And that was very obvious in some of the more recent devices produced. But that was as much about kind of changes in the industry, in the software, as it was about the people, who undoubtedly extremely talented. And, you know, it was most obvious in imaging. But as I say, as you rightly say, that was probably evident elsewhere. You know, even in things like design and material choices, you know, we were just talking earlier about kind of the last great metallic smartphones and how things have become a bit more standardized now, and all of that. And that all plays into that same story, I think.
Yeah, and you're absolutely right. The point about commoditization of the industry is a very good one. So, of course, famously, even Apple, I mean, they don't make their own phones. They use a cheap Chinese subsidiary, Foxconn, and they just basically, here's our design. This is how we like it to look. Here are the materials. Here are the components. Go off and build it. And there are other big OEMs like Foxconn that do the same thing for just about every other manufacturer in the world now. BlackBerry, for example, with the Key One, which was launched a couple of days ago. Available a couple of days ago. I think, isn't that made by TCL?
That's right. You know, the Alcatel OEMs brand.
Yeah.
And you know, Apple in some ways is the exception. I mean, but yes, you're right. You know, they've kind of outsourced the manufacturing. I mean, it's a very close collaboration, obviously, there. Yeah. So I think that's a slight misnomer. You know, they've taken a lot of the tech in-house, and actually they're about to do it with the graphics chips. And the impact that had on Imagination's share price was interesting. But you look elsewhere, and it is a much more commoditized world. And certainly the lower down you go, the kind of the more commoditized it gets, both in terms of pricing, but also kind of lower into the, certainly it's, that's what happens with manufacturing and mass market, you know. So I think that is part of the story. I mean, and we should go to number one, shouldn't we? And you're saying the biggest problem was stopping production of first-party handset and not spending money where needed.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And get all kinds of ties into commoditization. Just going back, you mentioned that Nokia had this entire infrastructure of factories churning out handsets that were all branded Nokia. I mean, Nokia owned the factories. They were playing the staff. We've now gone into a world where basically to make a smartphone, you just need to throw money at an OEM and say, here's our design. Here's what we'd like. We'll pay you X amount per handset. You deliver X million back to us and we'll sell them. And we're moving into that kind of world. And given that my point is, given that Microsoft has something like 100 and something billion dollars, admittedly some of it's offshore, so there may be some tax implications, but basically they've got an awful lot of money, and that's billions with a B, not millions with an M. It doesn't take that much money to get a smartphone off the ground, especially if it's going to be a flagship one, and you're kind of like a Nexus stroke Pixel arrangement. You're not trying to sell 100 million of things. We're just trying to sell a 10 million or 1 million to really high profile. It's going to be an absolute standout device. It's going to lead the evangelism for your platform. That's what's needed, really. And I can't understand why, given that, say, it only takes $50 million, say 50 million, pluck a number out of the air, to design and specify and procure from an OEM a Surface phone, or whatever you want to call it, a Lumia 960, something along those lines, with apps, you know, Snapdragon 835, cutting edge specs, cutting edge design, beautiful unibody, fingerprint scanner, the whole works. The 950 XL camera, I think it could be done for $500 or $600, and it doesn't matter if Microsoft even doesn't make any money whatsoever in it. They've got over $100 billion in the bank, and their lack of presence on mobile, their lack of such a device, a halo device for mobile, the most important growing sector of the industry, the lack of a halo device is massively hurting their perception across the whole of the tech industry. Surely, why on earth can't they use at least one of those billions just to get involved again and to do something? Is it that they're waiting for the software to be ready? Is it waiting for some part of the jigsaw behind the scenes to be ready and to be filled in? I just don't know. I do not understand what they're playing at with their money.
Well, I think there's a big boring answer to this, which is, it's just not how companies operate. They look at profits and loss, and they look at it on a quarterly basis.
Boom.
And for Microsoft, it's just not a profitable thing to do. You know, could you make an argument that strategically they need to be there? Well, yes. I think actually they've kind of done that by continuing to do some things in mobile, just not to the level of to get Steve Litchfield's seal of approval.
Indeed.
And as I say, I think, you know, it is probably as simple as that in terms of profit and loss. And of course, they've got lots of money, but you don't get lots of money by sort of throwing something away on something that isn't going to make you money. That's just the way it is. I mean, would I like to see them do it? Yeah, of course, because you'd like to see a bit more competition. But I mean, this also dates back to kind of the strategic shift that Satya Nadella announced about being cloud first, mobile first. And there wasn't, you know, being a big first-party device manufacturer wasn't part of that. I mean, it can be somewhat quixotic, though, because, you know, you look at the Surface line and see they're making money out of that. That's become a billion-dollar business for Microsoft. Could they not have done the same in mobile? I think this is where you have to accept that Android and iOS kind of won the ecosystem wars in mobile. And, you know, Microsoft just... You're right, you could do a relatively small investment, and actually I don't even think it needs to be as much as 50 million. I think it'd be a lot less than that. Certainly on the hardware side, you could do that with a very small amount, relatively speaking. Getting the software there would be more expensive, and I think that's the thing that's kind of become more evident as the overall quality, particularly with the Windows 10 mobile releases, maybe came down. And we've talked about the fact, you know, you have to wait for it to become a bit more stable in the past. But then actually the cost of the money to build the ecosystem, that's enormous. And actually Microsoft tried to do that, you know, and basically failed with the kind of Windows Phone 8 to, you know, early Windows 10 mobile time period. And now it's not quite clear what they're doing. And this is where we've been quite realistic talking about, you know, it's become something that is clearly not a mainstream mass consumer thing. And so are they doing enough to keep that kind of interest going? I mean, we said we'd have liked to have seen another flagship, you know, now or a few months ago or as soon as possible. And it doesn't seem like that's going to happen. So that is a big gap. But then because it's not mass market, it's not aimed at kind of making money that way. No, they probably don't need to, because they will keep a bit of interest going. And so we're in that hard situation where we're basically not satisfied as, you know, people who like the Windows mobile devices. But I can see this in the context of the kind of the bigger kind of boring, as I say, corporate picture, with this, which is just about that profit and loss and the strategic priorities for Microsoft. And actually, if you know, you divorce yourself from being interested in Windows mobile devices and the first party things, actually you look at Microsoft mobile strategy recently in terms of making their services and their software available on other devices. The most recent release is, you know, from Wunderlist, they've now got To-Do, you know, Sunrise, and going into Outlook, and all those things actually has been pretty successful. You know, you're seeing those apps used by tens, if not hundreds of millions of people on Android and iOS. So kind of keeping that Microsoft name alive on mobile. And then you compare it to, you know, a few million first party devices that sort of actively, you can see where the conclusion comes to. And so, you know, could you make the argument that Microsoft is more successful now in mobile in the broader sense and is getting ready for the next generation with things like HoloLens and, you know, 3D and all of that? Yeah, I think you probably could. It doesn't mean I'm not very sad about it. And would I like to see them put a little bit more onto first-party devices? Absolutely, you know, purely from a personal point of view. But I kind of have to be the slightly miserable person and see. I can also see it from a purely from a commercial and business point of view. But yeah, you're right. You do look at it and you see things like LinkedIn and lots of other acquisitions, and you go, we don't have a full picture. We don't see it. And we've, you know, played armchair CEO plenty of times over the years. We've just been talking about the mistakes of Nokia. That's the whole point of an article like this. But, you know, I can't, it's kind of a, you know, Windows Mobile in the first party sense didn't make it, kind of get over it and enjoy actually what Microsoft is doing in this space even now. And actually they are continuing to make investments. You know, that's what I'd say to you, Steve. You know, that software, Windows 10 Mobile, what we were talking about earlier in the podcast, that doesn't come for free. That's a big deal. The fact that they're still doing that does suggest to me actually there probably will be a first party device, a new one, quite soon. We'll have to wait and see. It'll be interesting to watch. But also, I mean, honestly, part of me, the bigger thing, I don't actually really care about the software platform so much anymore. I marvel at the things that these devices can do. And actually, you know, just as the hardware is commoditized away, actually, I kind of think, you know, the software and the platform has almost started to be commoditized away, because actually more in terms of the experience that you have with your phone matters on the stuff that sits in the cloud and to a certain extent the apps and the services associated with that. But, you know, when they're common across the device, and I'm talking about iOS and Android in particular here, and obviously it doesn't apply so much to Windows, you know, what is it that matters? What is it that creates the value? And actually it's the things that connect into other bits of the commercial world, you know, being able to buy things, order things, all of that. You know, does you know, someone like Amazon or whoever we talk about care whether you order it from a Windows device, Android, or iOS? No, of course not. And that's actually what's going to drive things forward. And, you know, for someone like Google or Apple, they obviously do still care because they control the platforms. But, you know, they have a challenge as well, because, you know, do they become less important when for consumers the value is less about, you know, that Google or Android platform and more about what keeps their photos safe and being able to view those, which is why you see, you know, Apple doing iCloud and Google doing Google Photos. And so thinking about that bigger picture, again, I guess it comes back to the thing, I think the smartphone industry has changed. So the context in which we talk about it has changed, and it's almost unrecognizable to, you know, the early days of the smartphone. Think back to the 3650 or even the N95. That world is different and gone now. So that's the, you know, and they didn't, you know, Nokia, Microsoft didn't win that race. Apple and Android did. And of course, the interesting thing is to speculate the same thing is going to happen in the next 10 years. The goalposts will move again. Who will come out on top then? That'll be really interesting to watch. And I think Microsoft absolutely has a chance to come back either as a software provider or with things like HoloLens and AR and all of that layer. And actually already has. I mean, the Microsoft Cloud powers a lot of the things that you use day to day on the iPhone and Android without even being aware of it. Talking more from third-party apps and services. But, you know, hopefully you see the point I'm making. That, you know, when you write history, you have to look at it and consider it in the history of what's going on. I mean, I agree with all your points. These are, if you like, where the mistakes were made. But I guess the interesting thing for me is to consider why were those mistakes made, not so much the mistakes themselves. Although, yeah, I mean, it's a great discussion. We could probably talk for hours about this, Steve.
Yeah, well, I'm just making a note in my diary. For here we are. So this is 2027. I'm going to do five mistakes Microsoft made over the last decade. Written, and I'll write that article in 10 years' time. It's a fascinating discussion. This could go on for a while. I mean, it's incredible how the technology has moved on. I was mentioning in my last phone show about GPS that I remember mid-1995. Sitting in the middle of a field for 20 minutes in an open field with nothing on the just empty horizon, and after 20 minutes I got a fix of my position on the planet on one of the first handheld consumer GPS devices, and I was so excited that it worked, and it sucked four AA batteries dry in 2 hours. And now we can get position on almost any phone anywhere in the world within two or three seconds, and it uses 100 times less power. And that's just unbelievable. And just on the commodity, you're talking about the way things tie in and services and whether the platform's as important. And absolutely no. I mean, my technology, my hardware in the house is nothing really special here, but I can start writing a tweet on, I'll do a tweet on Frax my MacBook. And 10 minutes later, I happen to be on my Windows phone, and there's a reply, so I can reply to that. I might then view some more Twitter content related to that on my Surface Pro. And then later on, I happen to be using my iPad in the living room, and I can carry on again. And the services are now so ubiquitous and so joined up and so cloud-centric that everything we have is backed up all the time and thoroughly Absolutely. Joined in, and we can interact with it on any device, even in theory, down on like HoloLens and smartwatches and Xboxes. They're all now connected, and at the operating system level, at the application level, at the API level, it's just a different world. And when I talked to my dad about this, who's in the 80-year-old generation, because it's completely over his head, because even I can appreciate how clever all this is, because I come from the generation where we didn't have this in the first place. And I know you're a young thing, Rafe, but talking to teenagers of today, of course, they've grown up where all of this is completely ubiquitous, and they don't appreciate how clever it is that we can do all the things we can do today. They just use them. And that's another fascinating aspect of all this.
Absolutely. And the fascinating thing is it will keep changing. So you wonder where we'll be in 10 years' time. And yes, it's harder to appreciate that context, either if you haven't lived through it or you sort of get left behind by it. So that's probably a pretty good place to draw a pause with this podcast. I'm sure it's a subject we'll come back to in the future. So I'm going to sign off and just say to everybody, thanks very much for listening. We always appreciate it, and we appreciate getting your feedback, and hear from you next time.
Yeah, and a thank you from me for listening, and we'll be back hopefully sometime in a week or so's time, maybe with Mr. Rafe Blanford or maybe with a guest. Let's see who pops up out of the woodwork, but bye for now.